Any comments on Israel? We're asking everybody today. Any comments
on
Israel?
Tell them to get the hell out of Palestine. Remember, these people are occupied, and it's their land, not German, not Poland.
So where should they go? What should they do?
They go home.
Where's the home?
Poland.
So the Jews,
Germany.
You think the Jews go back to Poland and Germany?
And America and everywhere else.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at cindysheehansoapbox.com. Today, like I always say, we have a very, very special Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Our first guest needs no introduction, so I won't even bother introducing her. Our second guest will be Scott Creighton, who has a very interesting perspective on the Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert rally that happened in Washington, D.C. But our first guest is, like I said, needs no introduction, even to people who aren't in the progressive community in the United States, journalist Helen Thomas. Helen Thomas, welcome, a very, very warm and wonderful welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you very much.
Like I was telling you before we started, I'm a little nervous interviewing somebody who's had such a long and courageous career as you have in a field that I am just breaking into right now.
You're too kind.
Oh, gosh, no. I can't. We don't have enough time for me to say enough good things about you today. So let's just get right into the interview.
All right.
So before we get into the interview, of course, many people know about what happened that led to your retirement. I don't want to talk about that right now. But I do want to talk about what. I do want to talk about what a pathfinder and trailblazer you were, especially for female journalists. And I want you to talk about some of those accomplishments in your career. You just had an amazing career over decades, and you did literally break some glass ceilings as a female journalist. Can you tell my listeners about those?
Well, we have a credo in our profession. You're only as good as your last story. There are always more mountains to climb. I did join a cabal when I first came to Washington because I wanted to get into journalism, and we did finally break down the barriers that the National Press Club had against women members.
Right.
So, I mean, the cause of being of discrimination has always been my big one.
Do you think that the discrimination was mostly against females in your early days, people of color, journalists, even males of color, or both?
Well, blacks had it much worse. Washington was a sleepy southern town, and the blacks were definitely discriminated against, much more so than women. We couldn't get into the professions that we had been trained for and had educated for. But we had a much easier fight.
Females had an easier fight. Well, well, now we see all kinds of, females and people of color in the profession, but it seems like the profession has lost a lot of its integrity over the years. What do you think happened? Why do you think now it's more, seems like a lot of times it's more for entertainment than for actual information?
I think the ethics and the standards of the profession have yet to keep up with the technology. I mean, it's run away from us, and there's no way to really bring back accuracy, which is the number one standard of journalism, to be truthful. And I don't see how any organization now that is not edited, I mean, anyone with a laptop thinks they're a journalist.
Right.
Anyone with a cell phone thinks they're a photographer. So there's no way, no controls yet. No one has invented one yet.
Well, what do you feel of your long, long career? A lot of my listeners, of course, know your struggles you had with the Bush administration. But you've been covering presidents since John F. Kennedy. What do you think was like the high moment in your career or the most favorite question you asked of a president or of a president spokesperson?
Well, I think it's been a great privilege to cover the White House and covering history every day. Being as close to the power center and yet not really attuned to everything that's going on. There's so much secrecy in government, and that's what people should truly be wary of.
Yes.
Thank God for the leakers. Thank God for those who really feel compelled to tell the truth. I think that every moment of being at the White House was privileged. Of course, the high point was the Kennedy administration, because President Kennedy had great goals. He understood the world. He had been in war. He knew he hated war. And he also knew that mankind had to constantly struggle for greater goals. When he said we're going to land men on the moon, everyone thought he was talking science fiction. But right. We did it. I mean, those were goals that were real. And he really uplifted everyone in terms of young people, telling them to go into public service, that excellence should be their goal, and so forth. All the wonderful cliches.
Do you think that what happened in the next administration, the Johnson, in contrast between the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration as being a journalist?
Well, Johnson was, I think, a great president on the domestic side. Of course, Vietnam was his denouement. He never could realize that it was impossible. And when he finally realized that it was impossible to win, he had the grace to quit. He did so much on the domestic side, Civil Rights Act, Medicare, voting rights for blacks for the first time in the South, federal education at all levels from kindergarten to college, public housing, environmental laws, so forth. There was no stopping in his first 2 years because he knew where all the bodies were buried. He knew every man's price on Capitol Hill.
Right. When I was studying history, one of the things I learned was that Johnson, no matter what his failings were, he was a consummate politician.
That was true, but that was very helpful in this case. I think that's where President Obama is missing the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to know how to play ball. And he has totally misunderstood the opposition. I mean, he actually believed that he could do business with them when they pulled down an iron curtain against everything he proposed.
Well, this leads beautifully to my next question. When I was researching for this interview, I saw where you said that the Obama administration is more secretive than the Nixon administration. Can you expand on that?
Can you repeat that?
I read where you said that the Obama administration is more secretive than the Nixon administration. Can you expand on that?
I do think that picking up on Bush administration secrecy and atrocities and so forth. I mean, Obama had a golden chance to negate all of this, and instead he's gone along with all of these things out of fear or whatever.
What are some of the policies?
Well, I think there's still the question of rendition, sending people to be tortured, still going on.
Right.
He had one chance the day after he took the office to get the hell out of this Vietnam. I mean, I'm sorry.
Right.
That's a Freudian slip.
Right.
They get out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
So besides
immediately, we had no right to be there.
Right. So besides, the secrecy and carrying on many of the Bush policies, what grade after almost 2 years would you give the Obama administration?
Well, half and half. I think he certainly has accomplished things that he's not being given credit for, which is the Health Act. But I wish he had let the government run more and more. He was very wrong not to do that. He played ball with the pharmaceuticals and so forth. And the financial reform certainly was very good, yet to see the results. I think he's missed the boat on employment and jobs.
Well, and then of course, it's almost like we rehearsed this. This brings me to my next question, leads it beautifully. Most of us think that the Democrats are going to lose control of at least the House of Representatives on Tuesday.
I cry.
And
that would be just a crime. Who brought all this on us? Two wars. Great Depression, I call it, not recession. I mean, who brought it on? It's the Bush administration, starting from Reagan. They did not believe in people.
And so do you think it's because of the economy and because they haven't been able to put Americans back to work?
I think that's the key role. Despite all the hate that's been spread around, I think that's what it is. People want jobs, want to work. And when the bailout occurred, the lenders, the bankers, would not give the money. They kept it.
Oh, right. Yeah, it didn't trickle down. It didn't have that trickle-down effect, did it?
Not at all. And the foreclosures are frightening. I mean, they're so sad.
Well,
Plus the mistakes that have been made in paperwork and everything else. Look at your phone bills. Fees you never even heard of.
Right. Well, when I look at the elections coming up on November 2nd and look at what people are saying, what the polls are saying, it doesn't seem like foreign policy, of course it's not a presidential election, it's a congressional election, but Congress should also have a profound say in foreign policy. It doesn't seem like foreign policy or the wars are much of an issue. Why do you think that is?
I think they love to forget it because it's too big for them, and they consider it the third rail of touching foreign policy, that it's supposed to be in the realm of the president while everything is local. But it's not. I mean, when you think of what it costs to run these two wars, it's incredible. We've spent billions and billions and billions going nowhere.
If Helen Thomas were president, and of course all my listeners would agree with me that that would be a great day, what would you do with Iraq and Afghanistan? What would be your plan?
Get the hell out immediately, yesterday.
So you'd tell your generals, just start bringing the troops out?
Absolutely. Wrap up everything. I know there'll be a lot of unemployment, but we can cope with that and do the right thing. Stop killing and dying for nothing.
Well, and we could, of course, put the money that, like you said, we're dropping into, I mean, it's just hemorrhaging money, those occupations. We could put that to good work here in the United States.
Exactly. We have invaded countries which we never would have done before. We have lost our moral compass. We've lost our morality.
So you said that thank God for the leakers and things like that. What effect do you think that the WikiLeaks, if any, have had on the policy? You're there in D.C. or you're retired now, but I'm sure you still have your finger on the pulse there. Do you think that the WikiLeaks, what's your opinion about that? Do you think it would have any bearing on foreign policy?
Sure. I think it scares the hell out of the administration when the truth is revealed. And I think that Americans are waking up more and more. They should know something is terribly wrong.
Well, we know that with especially the Iraq documents that many of those things occurred during the Bush administration. Why do you think the Obama administration is not just jumping on that and saying these have been wrong from day one? Instead of blaming the leakers, why don't they just seriously take this as an opportunity to, like you said, get the hell out?
No courage.
No courage. Well, that's something that you have plenty of. Well, Helen, since this show is taped, oftentimes when I have high-profile guests like yourself on, I ask my listeners if they have any questions for you. And again, as usual, the overwhelming question that my listeners have is about 9/11. You said yourself that you've been close to power without being in power or without being co-opted by that power,
right,
like someone like Bob Woodward is. Do you, what do you think about 9/11? What do you think really happened? That's what my listeners want to know. Do you think it was an inside job, like they say?
I have no idea whether it was an inside job. I think that certainly there was an attack by the basically the Al-Qaeda and so forth. But I think that it was a bonanza for the Bush administration to do what they wanted to do, which was to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing could stop them. Hans Blix begged. Let's go back in and see if these have these weapons of mass destruction and so forth. But Bush refused. He didn't want the truth out.
Well, and also...
And there have been no weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. No
right.
ties to Al-Qaeda at that right. time.
Right. What do you think is happening now in Iraq? Do you think that Al-Qaeda is a active participant? And do you think that it has been a recruiting ground for terrorists against us?
I think that the Arabs should be angry
mm-hmm.
of all of these invasions and killings and dyings. Why are we there? I mean, nobody really explained the truth of why we went into Iraq. In terms of Afghanistan, it was supposed to wipe out the breeding camps.
Mm-hmm.
We did that the first year. Now we're there now 10 years.
Right.
And everyone's killing and dying.
What do you think about the recent development that Russia, I can't call Soviet Union, that Russia is talking about joining NATO in Afghanistan in this occupation?
I think everybody looks out for their own interests.
Mm-hmm.
But Russia had the good sense to leave after 10 years. Nobody said Russia was weak. No one said, you know, this is very sad. They got the hell out, which is what we should do. And Afghanistan is called the graveyard of empires.
Right. Well, and even...
We don't learn from history.
No, it's almost like it never happened. Well, even Gorbachev has said that would be a terrible mistake for Russia to align with NATO against Afghanistan at this point.
Of course. What kind of stupidity would that be?
Well, it's amazing.
There are no peacemakers in the world left who are effective anyway, and they have any voice. It's one of the worst times of history, I think. When you have no one to lead back into sanity.
Well, let's stay in that part of the world. And, of course, you had to retire from your wonderful career.
I haven't retired. I was forced to retire.
Okay.
I don't have a job yet, permanent job anyway. I'm not out of the picture.
And then you know that Rick Sanchez of CNN was also fired for saying that Jews run the media.
Mm-hmm.
My listeners know, and in case they don't, why do you think that is such an untouchable subject?
Oh, it ties in with Israel, which is untouchable. I called it the third rail, and it is.
Well, absolutely.
You say one word about Israel in this country, and you're finished.
Well, and then someone like Juan Williams from NPR says the opposite. He says something about Arabs. And
that's
the,
right.
The people who called for your firing or for you to be held accountable are supporting him, saying that, claiming the First Amendment. Why wouldn't they claim the First Amendment in your case?
It's par for the course. Everybody cares about themselves and their own interests. And, of course, the Zionist lobby in this country is so powerful, and it's a one-way street.
What do you mean by it's a one-way street?
I mean that they have captured all of the public opinion.
Right.
And the Holocaust is mentioned every 5 minutes as though nobody else fought in this World War II. Every American family was affected. I had two brothers, many relatives, and so forth. Everyone paid the price.
And I think your point is, why should the Palestinian people be suffering because of that?
Exactly. They didn't do anything to the Zionists until they started to the gangs, Irgun, Haganah, Stern Gang, formed the Israeli army of Israel, and they plundered village after village, killing people to take their land. And there was silence on the other side, on the western side.
And, of course, our tax dollars and, like you said, public opinion, foreign policy revolves around support of Israel and just practically ignoring the rights of the Palestinian people. Most of, besides the 9/11 question, of course, the second question that my listeners had is, do you think a two-state solution is possible in Israel?
If Israel accepts it, it goes back to the 67 borders and
right.
stops aggressing and stops blowing up homes of long-time ancestral homes of the Palestinians coming from all parts of the world to say, this is our land, God gave it to us. No, I mean, everything is possible. We live from hope to hope. But, you know, the power driver is Israel.
Well, right. And what would be your ideal solution in that part of the world?
Get the Israelis back to the 67 borders.
Mm-hmm.
Make them accept reality. Stop settling, blowing up Palestinian homes, taking their land, their water, keeping them incarcerated.
Well, especially incarcerated in an entire region with a blockade of Gaza.
That's right, Jewish-only roads. Do you think any Zionist in this country would accept that?
Well, do you think anybody?
Specify one ethnic or racial or whatever religious group could
right.
use the word only?
What do you think about the possibility of a one-state solution with everybody living in peace and the Palestinians represented in some kind of parliament?
I think that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
They could learn from each other and help each other. That's what America is supposed to be all about, melting pot.
Well, and as,
best example,
right,
as, all religions, all people. Everybody has the same needs in the end.
And as most people don't understand, is that Jews and Palestinians, which Palestinians, people automatically think that they're Muslim, but they also have a diversity of religion. They coexisted peacefully in that region for centuries before 1940, was it?
That's right. The Arabs were 85% in the majority when Balfour Declaration said, you know, they're going to declare a Jewish homeland. No, Christians have been there by the millions. There are millions of Christians in the Middle East.
Right. And
but many of them have been driven out.
Right.
Of course.
Right, and of course, in this country, most of us think that Arab equals Muslim, and that's absolutely false.
Yeah, that's right. But the point is, all religions should be respected.
Or no religion should also be respected.
Right. You're right.
Well, Helen, we're almost out of time, and again, I'd like to really thank you for what you've done, but let's look to the future. What are your plans? You're still obviously very vibrant, very, you know.
Well, I want to die with my boots on.
Uh-huh.
I want to keep fighting for the right things that I think are right, for decency, justice for all, if that's possible. Even if it is, we can all work for it.
Are you looking for a new job? Are you writing your memoirs, or what are you doing right now?
Well, I think I'm writing a book,
mm-hmm.
and I do would want to resume writing a column.
Do you have a blog? Do you write regularly and post your blog on the internet at least?
No, I want to spare everyone.
Oh gosh, no. We still need you, Helen. We still need your guidance and your wisdom and your honesty and integrity.
Well, pray for Tuesday.
Well, I actually am. I think the two-party system in this country is corrupt, but I think that like you, we need to follow your example and be our own, citizen activists to lead this country. This country needs the people. It needs to follow the example of the people and people like you.
But a Republican victory will be a debacle.
Well, it's going to be a Republican victory, so that's going to give us an opportunity to get out into the streets and say that the government should be following us. We shouldn't be following the government.
Well, you got up a good point there.
Well, Helen Thomas, thank you so much. Is there anything you'd like to add that you think my listeners should know?
No, I wish you well, and I hope people will vote right and think right.
Well, we wish you well.
Not right,
Helen.
Left.
Far left, way far left, way past the Democrats.
Right.
We wish you well, Helen, and stay in
thank
touch
you.
And
thank you.
And don't deprive us of your wisdom.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you.
Wow, that was Helen Thomas. We're so honored to have her on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Stay tuned, and after this break, we'll be with Scott Creighton.
Major General Smedley Butler had these words to say at the National BFW.
War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. There are only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights. War for any other reason is simply a racket. It may seem odd for me, a military man, to adopt such a comparison. Truthfulness compels me to. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I am sure of it. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1910. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I feel I could have given Al Capone a few tips. The best he could do was operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small, inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the selfsame few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. It would have been far cheaper and safer for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people who do not profit. Take the World War. It cost the United States taxpayer some $52 billion, and we haven't paid that debt yet. but ultimately, it's the soldier who pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of decorations, they positively hunger for them." So, by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money, because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistments easier. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, kill, kill. To kill the Germans, God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies, to please the same God. Beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the war to end all wars. This was the war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them as they marched away that their going and their dying would mean huge war profits. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to help make them pay for the war too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, and kill and kill and kill. And be killed. Well, war is a racket, all right. And the only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital, industry, and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. Let all the officers, directors, high-powered executives, all the workers, managers, bankers, and yes, all the generals, admirals, officers, and all politicians, all government office holders, everyone in the nation, be restricted to a total monthly income not to exceed that paid to the soldier. Why shouldn't they? They aren't running any risk of being killed or having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. The soldiers are! Give capital, industry, and labor 30 days to think it over, and I think you will find by that time there will be no war. Another step necessary in the fight to smash the war racket is the limited plebiscite to determine whether a war should be declared. A plebiscite not of all the voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and dying. There wouldn't be very much sense in having the president of a munitions factory or the head of an international banking firm or the manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting on whether the nation should go to war or not. They never would be called upon to shoulder arms. Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for their country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. That would smash the war racket. That and nothing else. The next war, according to experts, will be fought not with battleships, not by artillery, not with rifles, and not with machine guns. It will be fought with deadly chemicals and gases. But victory or defeat will be determined by the skill and ingenuity of our scientists. If we put them to work making poison gas and more fiendish mechanical and explosive instruments of destruction, they will have no time for the constructive job of building a greater prosperity for all peoples. By putting them to this useful job, we can all make more money out of peace than we can out of war. So, I say, to hell with war!
I will promise you this, that if we have not gotten our troops out by the time I am president, it is the first thing I will do. I will get our troops home. We will bring an end to this war. You can take that to the bank.
Voices on the radio, until ASAP we go into war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. generals want to hear the end game.
Scott Creighton has written about Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and their rally to restore sanity and or to restore fear in Washington, D.C. on October 30th. Scott blogs at American Everyman, and he's written an article called Centrist Central, which is what we'll be mostly talking to Scott about today. Scott, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Well, thank you, Cindy.
Oh, thank you for taking the time to do this. Now, you have written not just this article called Centrist Central about the about Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Comedy Central, but you've written pretty extensively about Jon Stewart. I found when I was looking at your articles and things like that. And Jon Stewart has openly admitted that he has no integrity. His show is on Comedy Central, after all. And in your opinion, why do you think that this is so, can I say, dangerous?
Yeah, I absolutely think it's dangerous. well, my opinion is that right now this country and the people in this country are facing, really all the way around the world, we're facing an ideological revolution. And the idea that this moderate, million-moderate march that Jon Stewart is advocating is really kind of, you know, let's take the middle road, let's pretend that these problems don't exist. Everyone's doing kind of okay right now. And I don't think that's really where we should be. I certainly don't think that's where the Democratic Party should be. But obviously, he's taken that position because of support for the Democratic Party, I guess, because of this election that's coming up. I noticed that the day that he gave he gave the announcement for this million moderate march, this rally for sanity or whatever he calls it, they also had Bill Clinton on as their guest that day. And to be honest, I think it's really a perversion. It's a perversion of the ideal of the ideology of the Democratic Party, in my opinion.
Well, what do you think is the ideology of the Democratic Party? Are you a Democrat?
Well, I was. I was a lifelong Democrat. I even voted. I didn't vote for Barack Obama, but I'd voted for pretty much Democrat across the board up until that time, up until just after 2006, when I started, you know, kind of understanding what was going on. And then I really didn't like what happened with the Congress in 2006 and the shift that they made. They continued to funding the war under Pelosi and Reid. I think the ideology is becoming this neoliberal ideology, this Bill Clinton, New Dem, DLC type of party. And I think that's what people mean when they get angry, because they say we only have one party, the corporatist party. And I think a large part of that is that we have left the left half. We've tossed it off to the side, and now it's actually, you know, what they call the professional left or the extremist left, really is what the party used to be under people like Kennedy. It's really the party that used to stand for civil rights, for social justice, and now that's almost it's mocked, and it's mocked openly.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's not what I grew up on. It's not what I stand for. And I think that we can take it back, and I think we should take it back. I think we have to take it back, and that's where it becomes dangerous. It becomes dangerous because as neoliberalism takes place, as these changes, as these structural adjustments take place in country after country, and we've seen this everywhere from Iran in 1953, certainly in Indonesia and in Chile, as these changes take place, the people who install these changes know that the people aren't going to like them, and so what do? They start targeting union leaders. They start targeting unions. I mean, they practically made unions in Iraq illegal in 2003. So what they do is they target what they call the extreme left, and they start rounding them up. And that's what becomes dangerous, because we see that rhetoric coming from people like Glenn Beck. When we start to see that rhetoric coming from people like Jon Stewart, who supposedly represent the left, and now he's trying to rename the left as the moderate left, as these centrist left, then what ends up happening is it begins to build a climate, and a climate that becomes very dangerous of people who really are on the left, people who do believe in social justice, social equality, equal rights, workers' rights. And that's when you combine that kind of temperament, when that kind of atmosphere with what's about to happen as far as these IMF-type structural reforms, President Obama's cat food commission, which is about to release their recommendations, which we know what their recommendations are going to be as soon as the election is over. We start when we look at these things, historically speaking, this is not a good sign, and it can be very dangerous. Look what just happened with the FBI raiding the peace activists.
Right. Well, that's what I was about to say. You know, they have made it so people who are seeking peace are considered extremists. And when we talk about the democratic ideology and John Stewart not conforming to it, I think what he's doing is conforming to the new neoliberal ideology that you just described so eloquently. So he is like, it's not that, like you said, the old, you know, people who wanted civil rights, wanted peace, it's the new neoliberal agenda. And that just goes beautifully into my next question, which I think you may have already answered it, but I'll take the question in a little different direction. So John Stewart wants his million moderate march. And you in your articles say that it conforms to the Washington Consensus. Now, the Washington Consensus isn't a term that very many people have heard or used, or who would use in an article, you know, talking about a comedian, basically a comedian that has, like you point out, admitted he has no integrity. Can you, instead of talking about why you think it conforms to the Washington Consensus, because I think you already answered that, can you tell my listeners exactly what is the Washington Consensus?
Sure. Well, the Washington Consensus is kind of a rough term that addresses this centrist ideology, and the centrist ideology is basically an economic ideology that you can basically sum up with like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank's structural reform policies.
Right.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. And that is. It's. I think it was referred to once by Hugo Chavez as savage capitalism, and that's basically what it is. It's free market ideology that came along. I think it was first. Naomi Klein first started. She wrote about it, and she focused primarily on the beginnings of it being 1973, the overthrow of the democratically elected president Allende.
Uh-huh.
And basically what it was is that the idea of social justice and real democracy was going to be cast out and cast aside, and instead put in its place a very vigorous neoliberal economic structured reform. And that ideology wasn't very popular on the left in the early 1970s, but it became more popular as it grew in its strength. The 1971 Lewis Powell memo basically came out and outlined how they needed to implement this kind of ideology here in the United States, and it focused primarily on things, institutions creating these think tanks. And so you see all these think tanks created after 1971 that started to push this idea, this ideology. Mm-hmm. And they also talked about going after the colleges, going after newspapers. You don't want to call it really fascism, but I don't really know of any other term that I could use to compare it to that is closer to what neoliberalism really is. And this idea, once money started getting into it and the corporate interests started getting into it and they started funding the think tanks and, of course, they started paying off the writers and the journalists, eventually, over time, it bled its way into the Democratic Party as well. So it was part of the Conservative Party and the Republican Party, and it was part of the Democratic Party as well. And then, of course, it was completely sold out. The Democratic Party was completely sold out when the new Dems were created and the Democratic Leadership Conference was created.
Right.
So basically, that's kind of when you say America is a one-party, corporate party country, that's what you're talking about. I call them the neoliberal party. And that's kind of the Washington consensus.
Right. Thank you. Do you believe that John Stewart knows what neoliberal means, what the Washington consensus means? Do you believe that he is a willing participant? Do you believe that he's being used by the establishment, or do you think that it's more sinister than that?
Excuse me again. I'm sorry. I can't get rid of this cough. In a short answer, I would say he's a willing participant. It's just as much as I would say anybody who buys into this and rises up the corporate ladder, they all have to buy into the corporate agenda. If they don't buy into the corporate agenda, they're not going to be there. And it's a very small group of people. It's a very small group of organizations. I mean, Viacom is, what, one of six controlling almost every single television station we have. Do I think he knows what neoliberalism is and the Washington consensus is? Yes, absolutely. John Stewart, I mean, I don't really want to turn this into a thing about John Stewart, but like you said, I have written many articles about him. And it's because I was angry, like anybody else. You know, and when he did that thing, when he went out there with Tucker Carlson, and he said, why are you hurting America? Stop it. Stop hurting America. I believed in John Stewart. Like everybody else on the left, I said, this is awesome. He talked about, the guys tried to say, look, you know, we're just here doing this debate. And he said, you're not debating. This is not debating. What you're doing is a facade. It's a lie. It's the WWE. You're serving the political interests and the corporate interests that back them. Now, this is exactly what he said, I think it was 2006, and it won him a lot of credibility. Well, every corporation is going to look at everything that it owns as an asset. Viacom is no different. Sumner Redstone is absolutely no different. As soon as 2008 rolled around, the election was over, and Barack Obama was in place in early 2009, what happens? You see a big shift with Jon Stewart and with Stephen Colbert. I mean, Stephen Colbert actually went so far as to be shipped over to Afghanistan and had his head shaved by a general because Barack Obama came on a big screen TV in front of a bunch of the soldiers and our troops there and told him to shave his head. And so they shaved his head. And basically, I mean, they weren't showing how the Democrats support the troops. They were rebranding the Afghanistan war so that the people on the left would accept it. And that's how the corporations use their assets. Stephen Colbert is an asset. John Stewart is an asset. He knows, to answer your question, he knows what these things are. He knows what this process is. But yes, he is absolutely 100% behind it. And you know that just recently when he was called out because he made a comment that Truman had committed war crime by dropping these atomic weapons. And, of course, you listen to what he said, and that was from his heart. 24 hours later, he comes back on, and not only does he step away from that, but he actually has the audacity to say, holding that idea is stupid. Believing that there were war crimes committed by Truman at the end of World War II is a stupid idea to have. So he not only steps away from it and backs away from what he actually believed, his true beliefs, his true feelings, but he actually condemned them. And he did that for one reason and one reason only, because he remembers what happened to Phil Donahue back in 2003. He didn't want to lose his access to celebrity. He didn't want to lose his access to power. And that's it.
Well,
I mean, it's,
you know, John Stewart has very, you know, several times in the past felt very free and comfortable to make fun of me. And when I was at Camp Casey, you know, and other things that I've done, he's openly, like, poked fun at me. And I thought it was funny. I laughed because, you know, in reality, it is a comedy show. I laugh when Bill O'Reilly says something stupid about me because, you know, I just believe that it's not really news. It's just entertainment. But when I met with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, I'm glad you mentioned Hugo Chavez previously, John Stewart basically called me crazy for meeting with Hugo Chavez. And I think that John Stewart and Bill Maher are shills for the demonization of Chavez in Venezuela. But Jon Stewart won't allow me to be on his show to answer these charges. Why do you think that he won't have me or Noam Chomsky or somebody like that on his show?
Well, I mean, I guess he won't have you on the show because he's got too many ex-neocons selling their books. He's got them all booked. I mean, didn't he just... He just recently, on the 13th, I think he had Condoleezza Rice on selling her book, right?
Right.
So, I guess that's his, I guess you can see where his priorities are there. What he's doing with that is he's rebranding these people. He's helping, he's really kind of helping to rewrite history by bringing these neocons on and these like John Yoo. He's bringing these people on and he's helping them to refabricate in the eyes of the left, some kind of a new history of what they actually did. He doesn't go after them.
No.
You're probably, in my opinion, you're probably lucky not to go on there because he'd sandbag you, be my guess. Look what he did with Rod Blagojevich just recently. The guy was acquitted on all except one of his charges. He goes on John Stewart's show, and Stewart sandbags. Basically almost calls him a liar to his face on television. I don't know. I mean, I've never seen the episodes the things where he was actually talking about you and mentioned you. I stopped watching him a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Why he does it with these neoconservatives, again, I don't think he's the one making these decisions. It's his producers, and it's the owner of Viacom, I guess. Remember, Stewart is an asset, and they're going to use him as such. And I guess rebranding these people, these, in my opinion, these war criminals. I mean, look at Scott. I'm sorry. Look at what he had. He had how many times has he had? Obviously, he had Bill
Crystal?
Clinton on.
Bill Crystal.
Oh, he's had tons of them on. He's had Bill Crystal on. He's had Kissinger on.
Right.
I was thinking about Madeleine Albright.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, think about what Madeleine Albright said in 1996. She was asked point blank on 60 Minutes, right to her face, about, you know, did she think it was worth it causing the starvation and the death of 500,000 Iraqi kids for, you know, an attempted regime change, which at that point hadn't even happened in Iraq. And her answer was yes. She didn't miss a beat. She didn't question the numbers. Now I think the numbers are closer to 567,000 children under the age of five, you know, who died. Unpleasant deaths. And it was all about changing a political structure in a country. Now, if you look up the definition of terrorism and you want to understand what terrorism is, that's it. You target the population in order to change and make a political or economic change in the country. And that is exactly what she was talking about doing. That's exactly what she confessed to doing. And when she goes on, John Stewart, you know, he plays, you know, patty cakes with her.
Patty cake with almost everybody that I... Lynn Cheney on. He played patty cake with her. But we just have a couple minutes left, Scott, and I want you to talk about, because my next guest after you is going to be a Republican candidate for Nancy Pelosi's seat, John Dennis, and I want to want you to talk about the petition that you did. I think, was it in 08 that you made this petition?
I think it was in early 08 or at the end of 07, yeah, so early 08, right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Talk about the petition.
This was a petition to replace Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, and there was a way to do it, and it was the same way that Dennis Kucinich was able to put forward a petition or his effort to impeach Cheney, to bring it forward as a question of privilege. And I put this thing out there in hopes to get enough people behind it because for two reasons, actually. Because, first of all, after a year of being in charge of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, who had promised, and we gave them control of both the House and the Senate with this very thing in mind, and that was that they would defund these wars, they would stop funding these illegal wars and these illegal occupations of foreign nations, bring our troops home, and then... They refused to do that. Nancy Pelosi refused to do it and continued the funding of these wars. And then she also refused to allow the petition to impeach George Bush. And she said that was completely off the table.
Right.
George Bush is a war criminal. I don't care what John Stewart says. I don't care what Arianna Huffington says with her moderate bus. He's a war criminal. And to say he isn't, that's not sanity. In fact, I mean...
Well, if you say George Bush is a war criminal, then you have to extend it out to Barack Obama because he has only continued and, in fact, enhanced George Bush's policies.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, December 17th, 2009, he gave the order to fire a Tomahawk cruise missile in Yemen, a country we're not even at war with, which ended up killing 49 civilians, 21 of which were children. He is a war criminal. You're absolutely correct. His policies are illegal and immoral.
Just like George Bush. Well, Scott, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you for being on the show, and thank you. Where can people read your article? I'm going to link that article at my website when we have the interview this Sunday when it's on the air. But where can people go to reach you or read your other blogs?
Well, I have an American Everyman. You can Google American Everyman. I think I'm number one or number two on that list. And you can go to www.willieloman.wordpress.com.
Okay, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, Scott.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's Soapbox. I hope you have a great and safe Halloween. And I'd like to thank, as always, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, who arranged the interview with Helen. I'd like to thank Helen and Scott for participating, and you, as always, for listening. For the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be in Europe talking to communities in Europe, and I'll be with the people who are in the struggle against austerity measures to find out how we can do that here in the United States as the United States is increasing its austerity measures against us. So I hope you go to the archives, listen to some of our fabulous old shows. Again, this is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know. The air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone.
I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.